Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
How are you feeling today? Pretty good? Did you manage to avoid that nasty cough your sister-in-law brought to Thanksgiving dinner? If you did, high five. But brace yourself, because you're carrying around more bacterial cells than human ones, not to mention the huge numbers of virus particles and fungal cells. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It's not just you, though. It's all of us, even when we are perfectly healthy. In fact, our bodies rely on beneficial microbes to stay healthy, and my guest believes it's time they got due credit. Rob DeSalle is curator of entomology at the Sackler Institute for Comparative Genomics at the American Museum of Natural History. His new book, written with Susan L. Perkins, is called Welcome to the Microbiome, Getting to Know the Trillions of Bacteria and Other Microbes in, On, and Around You. Rob, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
This book drove home for me the idea that every individual human is a walking ecosystem.
Oh, that's correct. And not just a single ecosystem, but a collection of ecosystems. So, for instance, your underarm is a kind of a steamy, sultry, rainforesty kind of an ecosystem, whereas your forehead is more of a oily ecosystem, and other parts of your body we won't mention have other very, very important but different kinds of ecologies that foster the growth and lives of microbes.
Define a microbiome for us, if you would.
A microbiome, it's a kind of a funny word, and it's one that Susan and I in the book have tried to get the public over their kind of fear or disdain for the word. A microbiome is just the collection of the microbes that are living in an ecology on your body. It could also refer to the genes that are being expressed in one of those ecologies, but for the most part we like to refer to it as the collection of microbes that are in these ecologies that exist on our bodies.
I guess the reason that it is a subject that kind of creeps people out is because we tend to think of ourselves as microbe-free if we're feeling healthy, but in fact our bodies wouldn't work right without a lot of those organisms.
That's absolutely right. And as a matter of fact, our digestive system, we've co-evolved with these microbes for millions of years, if not hundreds of millions of years, and these microbes have forged a kind of a détente with our bodies, and we just need to maintain that détente through various ways of thinking about how these microbes interact with us. So, you know, our diet has an impact on us. The kinds of things that we do with respect to cleanliness has an impact on them. But there are certain microbes that live in and on us that are absolutely essential to our existence. There are microbes that digest certain things in our digestive tracts that we simply cannot digest. And they're very, very important, again, because they have co-evolved with us for millions of years.
If we could collect up all those microbes in an individual adult human body and put them in a container, would it be like a Dixie cup? Would it be a Starbucks cup? Would it be a bucket? How much would there be?
I like to say that if you took all the microbes out of your body and slopped them into a bucket, it'd be about 3 pounds for the average human.
That's about how much the brain weighs, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. It's about how much the brain weighs. And you know, we consider the brain an organ in our body, and there's no reason why we shouldn't consider these microbes a new kind of an organ in our body. In fact, a lot of researchers are calling the microbiome, the collection of microbes, as 3 pounds of stuff, the hidden or missing organ in our body.
Hmm. They start taking up residence as we pass through the birth canal to start our lives. What kind of, I don't know, starter kit do we acquire from our mother's bodies?
Well, we acquire, there's two ways that Western cultures give birth, and one is through the birth canal and the other is through cesarean section. And it depends on which one you were born. I was born as a C-section baby, and so my first microbiome was given to me from the doctors and nurses and the operating room that I was in when I was delivered. And any child who is naturally delivered through the birth canal gets their first microbiome from their mother's birth canal, which is a collection of microbes that exist in the mother's birth canal that are quite different from the microbes that would be floating around in the delivery room that you would get from a C-section.
And that's why a lot of people now think it's ideal to have a vaginal birth if that's medically possible, because that's a really helpful little start on health within the world.
Yeah, that's the general thinking on the problem, and the microbiome of the birth canal has again co-evolved with the mothers, and the birth of a child through the birth canal is the general normal way that birth was accomplished in the past, and so there has to be this again co-evolutionary interaction of the microbes in the birth canal with the infant that comes through it, and so disrupting that long-term evolutionary relationship is probably not the best thing to do. And so a lot of people who work on the microbiome, especially of the birth canal of the female genital tract, suggest that natural childbirth is the best way to do it, if at all possible. Now, of course, there are situations when it's not possible to deliver a baby naturally, and in those cases, a C-section is absolutely necessary. So, as I pointed out, I'm a C-section baby, and I've made it 61 years, so it's not so bad being a C-section baby.
We talk about infants having an immature digestive system, right? So they can only digest breast milk or formula for the first few months. Is that because they don't have all the gut bacteria that they will need to eat food?
Well, that's part of it. The amniotic sac, the part of the reproductive tract that the baby develops in, is a relatively sterile environment. There's some research that indicates that it may be a little bit more variable than we think it is, but in general, it's a very, very sterile environment. So the infant needs to acquire its microbiome from the environment. And part of the environment, again, is that birth canal that the baby comes through. But the microbes that the baby is acquiring through the birth canal are very different from the microbes that the baby will eventually end up with. And so the diet of the baby and the environment of the baby becomes very, very important for the kinds of microbes that the baby ends up with in their digestive tract. And indeed, as we develop, as we grow in our lifetimes, our microbiomes change from one stage of our lives to another, and indeed from day to day. There's some very clear research that's been done showing that the microbiome of various parts of the body changes from day to day and cycles through various cycles.
Okay, so different parts of the body, as you mentioned earlier, amount to different climates for microorganisms, right? So the armpit is going to be different from the back of your hand or your shin. But I wonder if similar kinds of skin, if the skin on the top part of your foot is so different from the skin on your outer thigh.
Yeah, there's two really good examples of that. One is the microbiome on your left hand is different from your right hand. And this is regardless of whether you're left-handed or right-handed. And if you think about this, if you're whatever handedness you have, you're using that hand to do a lot more things than you use the offhand. And so what happens is that, say, if you're right-handed, your right hand is much more active and experiencing a much, much different microbiome than a much, much different microbial set of microbes. And your left hand is experiencing difference. So you can actually tell the difference between left-handed and right-handed, the left hand and the right hand when you look at microbiomes. And the second example is one where researchers looked at the microbiomes of household items, and they had a whole list of household items. And it turned out that pillowcases had more similar microbiomes to toilet seats than they did anything else. And this is because the skin on your rear has the same general ecology as the skin on your face, say. Two points here. One is that very, very similar kinds of structures in your body can have different microbiomes, but very different structures on your body can have very similar microbiomes. So, this is the beauty of ecology. And when you think about these things, you need to think more in an ecological context than in, you know, simply, oh, it's my butt or my face, you know, that kind of a thing.
How do different microbes in our bodies tend to interact with one another? Are they symbiotic with each other in the same way that they are symbiotic with our bodies?
Well, certainly within a certain type of microbe or a certain so-called species of microbe, they're communicating with each other all the time through a process called quorum sensing. And this is just a phenomenon whereby they make molecules that they sense, and it's kind of their way of communicating with each other. However, there is a whole set of intricate interactions that microbes from different species have, and this allows them to form mats and biofilms in our bodies and on our bodies. And these mats and biofilms are sort of, as you pointed out, symbiotic kind of collections of microbes that allow these microbes to do their thing a lot better and a lot easier. So there is an immense amount of interaction going on in the microbial world at the level of within a species and also between species that tend to cooperate with each other.
I think people can understand that men's and women's microbiomes would be different in the sexual organs. Are they different elsewhere as well?
Yes. The seminal study that was done to understand this was done at the University of Colorado, and the researchers looked at the microbiomes of men and women in dorms, and it turns out that they're very different, more than likely because the cleanliness habits of men and women differ, especially at that age. Mm. Again, it's all about what the individual is exposed to. And we're a quirky species. We tend to do things pretty consistently. And again, in general, men will have a very different microbiome than women, simply based on their everyday habits.
How do our microbiomes change throughout our lives?
Well, again, we start out with almost nothing, especially if we're as we're delivered through the birth canal or through a C-section. We start with nothing, and then we gain an initial microbiome. And then as we're exposed to different environments, the more and more we're exposed to other people, our microbiomes start to change. And again, it's a matter of thinking about the ecology and the kinds of microbes that you're running up against as you go through your daily life. And if you think about, I'm getting old in my own way, and if I think about the kinds of things I did when I was younger, they're very different kinds of things than what I'm doing now. And so that change in external environment is changing the kinds of microbes that I'm exposed to, and then that is allowing those microbes that I'm exposed to come in and become part of my microbiome. So it's got a lot to do with behavior. And it's got a lot to do with the microbes that you're exposed to.
Rob DeSalle is my guest. He's curator of entomology at the Sackler Institute for Comparative Genomics at the American Museum of Natural History. His new book is called Welcome to the Microbiome, Getting to Know the Trillions of Bacteria and Other Microbes in, On, and Around You. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test-prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Rob DeSalle, who's curator of entomology at the Sackler Institute for Comparative Genomics at the American Museum of Natural History. His new book is called Welcome to the Microbiome, Getting to Know the Trillions of Bacteria and Other Microbes in, On, and Around You. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Rob, occasionally you'll hear that, not every species out in a particular forest has been categorized. Not every insect has been found. Is this also true of the microbes that live in and on us? Are there some that we have not perhaps yet identified?
Oh, my goodness. That's a great question. You've mentioned that I'm in the Department of Entomology, and that's the study of insects. But I really switched to microbes. To study microbes because there are so many of them. And it's just a wonderfully diverse group of organisms. And we've just barely touched the tip of the iceberg with characterizing the kinds of microbes that are out there. And it's almost turned the biology of understanding microbes upside down. We have a hard time telling what a species is in the microbial world. And because species or the kinds of microbes that are living on us and in us are kind of the currency of how we analyze things and make sense of things, this has caused some problems. So about 15 years ago, there were maybe 20 major groups of microbes that were known. And near as 2 years ago, that number had tripled. In the last couple years, the number has risen by an order of magnitude. So we still are just struggling with trying to characterize this vast, immense variation. And you have to remember that this variation is just in and on us. It doesn't even touch all of the microbes that are out there in and on other animals or in and on other environments. So the microbial diversity on this planet is just spectacular.
How much do our body's microbial passengers vary depending on where we live in the world, like what the climate is and whether we live in an urban or rural environment? Are two bodies more likely to be different if they come from very different places?
Oh, there's a wonderful study that addressed that, and it was done on the microbiomes of people in New York City and people in San Francisco and people in Tucson, Arizona. And not surprisingly, the people in the two major cities, San Francisco and New York City, had more similar microbiomes, and the people in Tucson had very, very different kinds of microbiomes. And so locality has a huge impact on the kinds of microbes that live on us. And another great study that was done was a study of roller derby women who play roller derby. Their skin was sampled for microbes, and there was a team from, I believe, the Bay Area, and a team from Oregon, and a team from the Midwest. And before they came to do their matches, their bouts, so to speak, their microbiomes were measured and they were quite different. And so depending on what kind of a environment you're from, your microbiomes are going to be very different. But during the match, believe it or not, during the match, the bouts in this roller derby example, the microbiomes of the girls got closer and closer. They became more and more similar because they're bumping into each other and sweating on each other, et cetera. So that's a really good example of how rapidly our microbiomes can change as a result of the environment that we're faced with.
There was one team, right, that was particularly susceptible to athlete's foot?
I don't remember that, but that may be very, very possible. And again, the athlete's foot is caused by a fungus, right? There is an interaction between the fungus and microbes, bacteria that live on your feet, that is kind of an ongoing battle. The microbes bacteria that live on your feet, Bacillus, can oftentimes stem a fungal infection. And that interaction is good. And so it's not surprising that you might have had different kinds of microbial communities on the feet of the women from the different areas.
So I understand that we have co-evolved with some of these microbes that live on us or in us, but tell us a little bit more about how our immune systems know the difference between the harmful microbes and the ones that are really beneficial for us.
Yeah, I like to look at our immune system as other researchers have, this is the kind of the bouncer analogy. Our immune system is kind of like a bouncer that lets good people in and keeps the bad people out. And so our immune system, it doesn't work unless it's challenged with these bad things. And so as we go through our lives, what we're exposed to really molds what our immune system is going to do. And so there is some anecdotal information on kids or children who are raised in farms or in rural settings versus kids who are raised in urban settings. And it turns out that kids who are raised in farm settings or rural settings have fewer allergies than kids who are raised in urban settings. So, and that has to have something to do with the microbes that the kids were exposed to as they were growing up. So the environment that you're exposed to really, really has a huge impact on your immune system, which then has an impact on the kind of diversity, microbial diversity that you have in your body and on your body.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Nancy on the line in Plano. Hi, Nancy.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I just wanted to tell you, my husband is a chemist, PhD, and he always has told me that I should have been a microbiologist because I've always been very concerned about germs. I've always insisted that we, if you can't wash your hands, always carry antiseptic wipes and, excuse me. And what I want to know is my kids tell me that they grew up too clean, washing their hands all the time and with fewer germs. And they said all their friends claim that they were never required to wash their hands and they don't care. They eat food that is really old, stuff that's been not refrigerated, that should have been refrigerated, foods like that. And they tell me that their friends don't have any intestinal issues like my kids do.
Well, thank you for your call, Nancy. What can you say about that, Rob?
That's a really interesting comment, and it's one that is being looked at by a lot of researchers nowadays, and in particular with respect to antibiotic use. The general rule is that if you use too much of anything, it's probably not a good idea. And with antibiotic usage, the indiscriminate use of antibiotics is probably not a good thing to do, because all you're doing after a certain point is selecting for microbes that are resistant to the antibiotic. And likewise with hand sanitizers, if you overuse them, all you're going to do is select for the microbes that are resistant to the hand sanitizers. So there is some truth to the idea that overusing these sanitizers and overusing the antibiotics is not a good idea. And wise use is very, very important with respect to anything. But it is turning out that wise use of antibiotics and antibacterial, say, hand soaps is becoming more and more important, because when you use them, as I said, when you overuse them, you're disrupting the ecology that's normally there and simply selecting for things that are not supposed to be there.
Speaking of ecology, you write in the book that we need E. coli to help with digestion, and yet many people know that it can be deadly if we ingest it from, like, contaminated meat or produce. Is it a different kind of E. coli?
Yes, it's a different kind of E. coli, not completely different, because we can still recognize it as E. coli. Though E. coli that is pathogenic has a little bit of the genome of another microbe called Shigella, and it's received that via what we call horizontal transfer. Horizontal transfer is simply the movement of genes from one organism to another without having sex. So in this case, the pathogenic bacteria have a chunk of DNA in them that is very different from E. coli that live in harmony in our guts, but you can easily disrupt that harmony as you pointed out by ingesting something that's got a high titer of a dangerous microbe.
Back to your bouncer example, I was interested in, I have been interested in Helicobacter pylori, if I'm saying that correctly, which in recent decades has been implicated in the development of peptic ulcers. Why are we carrying it around if it can lead to something so debilitating? I mean, not that we have a choice, but why are our bodies allowing it to remain?
Well, actually, in the last couple of decades, there's been a movement to get rid of it from our guts. And this is because it causes ulcers. It's thought to be the causative agent for stomach ulcers. And, of course, if you have a stomach ulcer, you want to get rid of it. And so if you get rid of the Helicobacter pylori, then you're going to more than likely get rid of the ulcer. But it turns out that Helicobacter pylori, and this is work that was done by Dr. Martin Blaser here in New York City, it turns out that Helicobacter pylori is also essential in preventing GERD, that is the esophageal inflammation, and is also important in regulating a lot of our function of our heart. And so if you get rid of Helicobacter pylori, you're removing an integral part of the ecology of your stomach, and this causes problems further on down the road with heart disease and with, as I said, GERD and other disorders. And this just simply points to the fact that when we think about the ecology, say, of our gut or the ecology of our underarm, we need to think about it in a broader context. You know, what things are there, how they're interacting, because if we take a piece of the machinery out, like Helicobacter pylori, then we're for sure going to be messing up the machinery, and something down the road, down the line, will more than likely be out of line and cause problems elsewhere with our health.
What have we learned about the relationship between gut bacteria and body weight or obesity?
There's some really, really interesting new experiments that are being done. Now, you have to remember a lot of the work that's being done on the microbiome and its relationship to disorders like obesity. When we study these things, we have what we call a correlation and causation. And we can correlate the use or abuse of antibiotics with obesity here in the United States, and antibiotics are going to affect the microbiome. So we can correlate those things. Now, that's not proving that that it's caused, that the use of antibiotics is causing this. So what you need to do is you need to use a model system like a mouse system. And so, as I said, there are some really wonderful experiments that are being done with mice as a model system. And these mice are actually sterile mice. They're mice whose guts have been sterilized and bred to have sterile guts when they're born. And you can seed their guts with specific kinds of microbes. And in fact, you can take identical twin mice and seed one with a certain combination of microbes and the other with a different combination. And you can watch those mice develop, and one will become obese, just fascinatingly obese, and the other will stay slim. And this is causative information or causative kind of an experiment to show causation of the microbiome in how obesity is influenced by the microbiome. Of course, we can't do that experiment with humans, so we have to fall back on the mouse system to really get us closer to causation. But we have to be very careful when we think about the microbiome and disorders like obesity and autism and things like that, in discerning between correlation, which is fairly easy to cook up, and causation, which is the real gold standard and the thing that we're after when we think about treatments for people.
So, for example, it could turn out that people who are obese or of normal weight, they have a different microbiome because the conditions of obesity or normal weight create different conditions in the gut, and that facilitates the thriving of different kinds of bacteria.
That's correct. But the other thing that you have to worry about there is that so far in humans, there's simply been shown that what's been shown is a correlation of the changes in the microbiome and obesity. And you also have to be aware of the fact that obesity is not a single disorder. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very complex disorder that has a microbial component to it, has a dietary component to it, and has a genetic component to it. And those are just three of many components that are there. And so, trying to pin this on microbes is probably not the best way to approach the problem of obesity. Obesity, again, is a very, very complex disorder. But uncovering the fact that microbes are involved is a step in the right direction.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Marshall in Denton. Hi, Marshall.
Hi. I was just wondering if there's a microbe colony or if the mouth or the tongue sustains microbes that aid in digestion or overall health while they're living inside your mouth cavity.
Yes, our mouths are incredibly diverse, filthy with bacteria, so to speak. And there are a few hundred species of microbes, bacteria, living in our mouths. This diversity is very, very important for the overall balance of our oral cavity health. If that balance is not kept, then certain things can happen, such as halitosis, bad breath, other things that are related to teeth. If the microbiome of your mouth is disrupted and not kept, certain microbes aren't kept at bay, then you're going to have teeth decay and gum disease, gingivitis, and things like that as a result of imbalance in the oral cavity. So the oral cavity is a really very active ecology that we're just starting to understand and just starting to make correlations of the kinds of microbes that are there with the kinds of pathologies that might occur in the oral cavity. Most of the microbial diversity in your mouth occurs on your tongue. Hmm. And so if you want to make sure that you get rid of the microbes from your mouth, you want to brush your tongue, not your teeth, really.
Rob DeSalle is with us from the American Museum of Natural History. He's got a new book out called Welcome to the Microbiome, Getting to Know the Trillions of Bacteria and Other Microbes in, On, and Around You. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test-prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rob DeSalle, curator of entomology at the Sackler Institute for Comparative Genomics at the American Museum of Natural History and co-author of Welcome to the Microbiome. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Rob, this time of year we hear all the time about the importance of thorough hand washing. What is left behind after we scrub up at the sink?
Well, surprisingly, there's probably a little film of microbes there. It depends on how well you scrub, but what's even more surprising is that very rapidly after you've done the scrubbing and somewhat sterilized your hands, is that your hands have been recolonized by a whole set of microbes that are fairly characteristic of you and of your surroundings.
So you're not saying it's not worth it to wash our hands, right? how should we think about this?
Well, the way I like to think about it, you may want to talk to your doctor about this, but the way I like to think about it is, getting my hands dirty is not a big deal, and I would only wash my hands when I know that I've been near something that's may have some contaminants on it, and so. I take the subway to work every morning, and when I get off the subway, I wash my hands right away because there's a lot of really unknown stuff down there. At the same time, if I go out and play with my son in the park, and I come home, I don't really care that much about washing my hands. However, if I then take the dog out for a walk and have to scoop something, I will come back home and wash my hands. So you need to be very judicious. I mean, part of the thing here is that we need to think more, and we need to think more about the kinds of things that we're around. And the more we think, the better prepared we are for thinking about when I should wash my hands and when I shouldn't wash my hands. So, and again, you have to bring in this concept of overuse is just not going to do you any good.
We have a tweet here from someone who wants to know what we've learned about the relationship between mental health and the microbiome.
Oh, goodness. That's a great question, too. And it relates to research that's been done recently on the what's called the gut-brain axis. And our guts are very, very intricately connected to our brains, not only via our nervous system, via a nerve called the vagus nerve, but also via the kinds of chemicals that our guts make, and then that triggers impulses that go to our brains that then influence our brain. And so, again, we fall back on mouse experiments, and there are some really, really cool experiments where mice have been fed certain kinds of microbes. These are the sterile mice, once again, that are fed sterile microbes, and then they're tested for whether they're depressed. Now, how can you tell what a depressed mouse is? Well, they have a test, and the test is they put the mouse in a little bit of water, and if the mouse furiously tries to stay afloat, then that mouse is considered depressed. And if the mouse simply just tries to float and doesn't panic, then that mouse is considered not depressed. And so you can see a correlation, a very nice correlation and indeed causation of the microbes that are fed to these mice that correlate with the depression versus the non-depression. So the microbial components in the stomach of these mice has a huge impact on their behavior and on whether they're, quote, depressed or not.
Wow. And we should note, as you do in the book, that they don't let the mice drown either way. If they stop struggling and just let themselves sink, somebody comes in and scoops them out. So.
Yeah, these mice have very good lives, I think. they're once the experiments are done, they're not sterile anymore, and so they're put out to pasture. They're allowed to eat whatever they want.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Chaz is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Chaz.
Hi. I've read a story about a man who was a microbiologist, and he decided that taking showers was perhaps not a normal human activity. So he came up with his own brew of bacteria, supposedly found around the barnyard and so forth, and sprayed himself with it. And the upshot of the story is he hasn't taken a shower for 12 years.
Wow. Would you work beside him, Rob DeSalle?
Well, it depends on the bacteria that he's putting on his body, because some bacteria can make our bodies really stink pretty badly. And what he's more than likely doing is he's spraying bacteria on his body that are counteracting these really smelly bacteria. And it sounds like it might work. And again, it's correct. Bathing, showering, probably it was not a daily kind of a thing that early humans did. Again, we tend to overdo things sometimes, and it may not, you know, I don't know. I that's a very, very interesting question and one that probably needs to be looked at in detail. There are some studies that cosmetics companies are doing and looking at microbial content and the impact of microbial content on how people smell. So there is some real kind of economic some economic value to thinking about this. And I think some of these cosmetic companies want to be able to package microbe sprays that eliminate some of the body smells that we have.
All right, I have a question for you about the bad sponge. You know what I'm talking about? When you get a sponge or a kitchen cloth and it needs to be cleaned and it has a kind of a funky odor.
Yeah, that's probably depends on the odor. I mean, if it's an odor that smells like cheese, then it's more than likely some sort of a bacillus that's gotten into the sponge and grown a little bit and exuded some chemicals that give you the smell. The other possibility is some sort of a fungus. Once the sponge starts to dry out, fungi can jump on the sponge pretty easily and exist on the sponge. But again, I wouldn't be able to. I wouldn't want to say anything for certain about that unless I did an experiment on it. Unless I actually surveyed the sponge and tried to see what the microbes were on the sponge.
How is it that some people, and poor Mary Mallon, Typhoid Mary comes up every time in these conversations, but some people can carry a dangerous pathogen and make other people sick without ever coming down with symptoms themselves?
Yeah, this is a situation where the person is immune to the pathogen, and that's pretty much what Typhoid Mary was. She was immune to typhus and simply carried her around on her hands, and when she understand she was a cook or a maid of some sort, and when she plied her trade, she simply transferred the typhus to other individuals, and the fever just moved rapidly as a result of her kind of spreading it. But it's kind of a luck of the draw whether or not you're immune to something like that. It would be very interesting to, say, analyze her genome and find out if she has specific kinds of genes that might render her immune to something like typhoid fever. But unless you have the experiment and unless you can do the experiment, it's very, very hard to say.
Tom in Wichita Falls sends an email and wants to know, as a 20-year-plus vegetarian, how his gut bacteria might differ from those of an omnivore.
So, Tom, your gut is probably in a lot better shape than mine. I eat a lot of potato chips and a pasta, and these are processed foods that are probably decreasing the microbial diversity in my gut, that are causing problems in my gut that influence my behavior and influence my overall physiology. And so the diet that we eat has a huge impact on the microbial diversity in our stomach, and diets that avoid processed foods are more than likely much better diets than those that ingest a lot of processed foods. There's some recent data on red meat, and again, my dictum is too much of anything is not good for you. A little bit of red meat is probably okay for you, but if that's all you're eating, you're probably going to have problems with your cardiovascular system sooner or later, and that's a result of the red meat influencing your microbiome in your stomach. Very clear experiments have been done to show that.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Pat on the line now in Fort Worth. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a son with Crohn's disease, and there are new procedures that are in clinical trials called fecal transplants, and I'm wondering if your guest has any information on the success rate of those trials.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that toward the end of the hour, because we're getting away from lunch, right? So we can talk about fecal transplants now. There is one case that I'm aware of where a fecal transplant has been incredibly effective. This is with Clostridium difficilis, or C. diff. C. diff is a gut bacteria that has attained kind of widespread resistance to antibiotics. And it causes severe problems with diarrhea. Individuals with C. diff infections in their stomachs are going to the bathroom 10, 15, 20 times a day. And indeed, people can die from a C. diff infection. So what researchers have done is they've figured out that the microbial content of a normal person transplanted into the stomach of a person suffering from a C. diff infection will decrease the C. diff, the numbers of C. diff in the gut, and increase the diversity of microbes in the gut and thereby get rid of the C. diff infection. And for C. diff, this has been about 80% or so successful in individuals who have C. diff infections. But to my knowledge, that's the only situation that's been tried and true. And as your caller just indicated, clinical trials are in progress for other kinds of treatments. Now, the only question that your listeners should be asking me is, which end do you do the transplant in? And they actually prepare fecal pills now that are timed to dissolve when the pill gets down into the large intestine. So the delivery is not through the bad end, but through the good end.
I have seen people in the grocery store like wiping down the cart handles like crazy, right? This has become a thing where there's like little sanitary wipes. And then they hit the checkout and they touch the same electronic card reader. Are we worrying about the wrong things? Are we wasting our time?
Yeah, I think we are. I think that what we need to do is we need to think more about the ecology of microbes around us and on things around us. And in that case, if you're gonna wipe down the cart, then you should probably wipe down the card reader too, and you should probably wipe down the counter and everything. And that's probably not a good way to treat the environment in that grocery store. Hmm. Because again, all you're going to do when you wash these things down is you're going to enhance the growth of things that are resistant to the antibacterial, to the soap or to the antibacterial or to the antibiotics. So overuse is the main problem, and it's something that should be in the back of the mind of everybody who's concerned about their health and who's concerned about the microbes that are around them.
Best way to make our bodies as hospitable as they should be to the microbes that do keep us healthy? Are you like a yogurt guy, or do you just sort of move through the world and not worry too much about it? Trust your body.
I don't worry a whole lot about it. I rely on microbes a lot. I really like to drink beer, and microbes are really important for beer. So, you know, any bad press that microbes get, I kind of get a little bristly about. But no, I think your question is fairly serious. I mean, it's up to the individual. And again, what we've tried to do with this book, and the book is actually based on an exhibition that's here at the American Museum of Natural History. What we've tried to do is educate the public about the microbes that are around us and in us and on us and how they interact with us and how we should be thinking about them. We need to change the way we think about them. And indeed, medicine is changing the way we think about our health as a result of knowing about all of these microbes that live in and on us. It's a complete paradigm shift in the way we think about our health.
Rob DeSalle is curator of entomology at the Sackler Institute for Comparative Genomics at the American Museum of Natural History. His new book, written with Susan L. Perkins, is called Welcome to the Microbiome, Getting to Know the Trillions of Bacteria and Other Microbes in, On, and Around You. Rob, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making this time for us.
It's been great talking to you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.